Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law, Litigation, and Professional Responsibilities and Legal Education Practice Groups, was recorded on Friday, June 3, 2016, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleforum conference call on proposed changes to the American Bar Association's Model Rules of Conduct. My name is Will Courtney, and I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Additionally, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome our expert, Professor Eugene Volokh. A more complete bio is provided you in the notice of the call, so I'll stop here to reserve more time for his presentation of about 20 minutes, followed by your questions. With that, Professor Volokh, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thanks very much. It's always a pleasure to be on these calls, and especially on an issue that's as important to lawyers as this one, lawyers and I think the rest of the country as well. A committee of the American Bar Association is urging that the ABA adopt a new provision in its model rules of professional conduct. As you know, those model rules are an influential document that many states have adopted as binding on lawyers in their state. So if the ABA adopts it, chances are that state bars and state supreme courts in many states will follow suit. So Rule 8.4 has to do with what constitutes professional misconduct for lawyers. So, for example, right now it bans engaging in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation, or committing a criminal act that reflects adversely on the lawyer's honesty. The proposal is to add a provision that bans lawyers from harassing or discriminating on the basis of race, sex, religion, national origin, ethnicity, disability, age, sexual orientation, gender identity, marital status, or socioeconomic status in conduct related to the practice of law. This rule does not limit the ability of a lawyer to accept, decline, or withdraw from a representation in accordance with the rules having to do with withdrawal. So this is a rule that covers not just in-courtroom conduct or even litigation conduct. So it doesn't just limit, for example, lawyers' actions towards witnesses or, for that matter, towards their clients. It applies to any conduct that is related to the practice of law. So that potentially includes, obviously, running one's own law office. But beyond that, the comments actually say that it goes even more broadly. It includes representing clients, interacting with witnesses, coworkers, court personnel, lawyers, and others while engaged in practice of law, operating a law firm, and participating in bar association business or social activities in connection with the practice of law, though it does not prohibit, quote, conduct undertaken to promote diversity, close quote. So this would set up this ban on discrimination and harassment based on all of these various criteria, not just in hiring and firing, let's say, and not just in the conduct of litigation, but also in presenting continuing legal education materials, presumably in going to bar social functions and having dinner at a lawyer's conference. After all, those are social activities in connection with the practice of law. So that's the proposal, and I think there are three different kinds of things that are wrong with it. One, which I won't discuss in much detail, has to do with taking anti-discrimination law, which is currently enforced equally for all professions and all businesses, at least ones that are large enough, based on certain kinds of prohibited criteria, and now applying it to lawyers as well through the rules of professional conduct, which could involve not just lawsuits, but threat of disbarment, for example. And not just when the discrimination is based on race or sex or religion, but also based on things like sexual orientation or gender identity, which many states do not prohibit, marital status, which even more states don't prohibit, socioeconomic status, discrimination and employment, generally most states don't prohibit. So what it's doing is, instead of just leaving it to state legislatures to decide, and to Congress as to a limited set of situations, to decide when discrimination is forbidden, it also urges essentially state bars and state courts to adopt these rules even beyond whatever or whatever criteria the state legislature has created. Obviously, the most controversial ones will involve sexual orientation and gender identity. Whatever you think is the right answer on this, some states have banned sexual orientation and gender identity discrimination in employment. Others have deliberately decided not to. This proposal would basically apply this in all states, at least urge, again, courts and state bars to apply this in all states. So in a state, it's sexual orientation discrimination or gender identity discrimination might not be illegal, but for lawyers, it would potentially lead to disbarment. I don't think that's right. I think that's an issue that should be left to state legislatures rather than to bar authorities. The second problem, which I will talk about, is how this essentially threatens to create a nationwide speech code for lawyers. And the third problem, which I'll touch on towards the end, is the addition of socioeconomic status, which I think is a particularly bizarre thing here. So first, let's focus on the speech code scenario. Say some lawyers put on a continuing legal education event that includes a debate on same-sex marriage, or on whether there should be limits on immigration from Muslim countries. I hear that was in the news. Or on whether people should be allowed to use bathrooms that correspond to their gender identity rather than their biological sex. In the process, unsurprisingly, the debater on one side says something that's critical of gays, Muslims, or transgender people. I mean, that's the nature of debate, especially on these topics. If the rule is adopted, that debater, if he is a lawyer, could well be subject to discipline by the state bar for his speech. After all, he has engaged in, quote, verbal conduct, close quote, that manifests bias or prejudice, close quote. Those are terms from the comments to the proposed rules that define harassment towards gays, Muslims, or transgender people. Some people view such statements as harmful. That's another requirement for something to be harassment, but certainly lots of people believe that the very expression of such views is harmful, and these people may well include bar authorities. This was done in an activity in connection with a practice of law. Continuing legal education events are certainly connected with that. Now, the statement isn't about any one person in particular, though it could be. The debater could say something critical about a specific political activist or religious figure based on that person's sexual orientation or religion or gender identity. But we know from the law of harassment in the workplace context that even speech that is about groups at large and isn't focused on a particular person can qualify as harassment. So that, it seems to me, is a very serious problem. And note, by the way, how this rule goes beyond what workplace harassment law does. I think workplace harassment law itself, in certain situations, poses pretty serious First Amendment problems. But at least it's limited essentially to the workplace, which CLE function would not be, but the CLE function is going to be governed by this proposed new rule. Or say you're at a lawyer social activity, like a local bar dinner, and say you get in a discussion with people around the table about these kinds of matters. It could be Islam, could be evangelical Christianity or Mormonism, or black-on-black crime or illegal immigration, differences between sexes, same-sex marriage, restrictions on use of bathrooms, the alleged misdeeds of the 1%, after all that has to do with socioeconomic status, cultural causes of poverty in many households, all sorts of topics like that, which might come up over dinner. One of the people is offended and now files a bar complaint. Again, you've engaged in verbal conduct that the bar may see as manifesting bias or prejudice and thus is harmful at a social activity in connection with the practice of law. So the state bar, if it adopts this rule, might thus discipline you for your harassment. And of course, this proposed speech code is overtly viewpoint-based. If you express pro-equality viewpoints, you're fine. If you express the contrary viewpoints, you're risking disciplinary action. So I think this is a really serious serious problem. Partly, just even symbolically, it would be the American Bar Association placing its imprimatur behind these speech codes. And this is a speech code just for lawyers, but the same logic could be used by analogy to support speech codes for doctors, speech codes for college students, college professors, whoever else. So I think that's bad enough. But beyond the symbolic, it'll have real concrete consequences, especially since, take it, none of us wants to even face a bar complaint. Imagine there's somebody out there who, perhaps perfectly sincerely, but is really upset at people engaging what they perceive as hate speech or harassment, And as a consequence, you know, they are assiduous about filing bar complaints, just like there's some disability rights activists who actively seek out places that they think are not providing adequate disability accommodations and file lawsuits against them. So in this kind of situation, they file a bar complaint, and you know, even if ultimately the bar will exonerate you, you're going to have to go through the time, the effort, the expense of defending yourself. That, I think, would cause a powerful chilling effect on people's speech on these kinds of topics. And I should imagine it's an intended chilling effect. I think the whole point is to deter people from engaging in what the bar may label as harassment, but which quite clearly is the expression of views, including political, religious, and social, moral views on a wide range of controversial topics in which there is a hot current debate, and lawyers will be silenced in that debate this way. And again, I think there are real problems with workplace harassment law when it ends up imposing these same kinds of speech codes. But note the constraints on workplace harassment law that this speech code does not include. First, harassment law is often defended, though in my view the defense is inadequate, on the grounds that it's limited to speech that's so severe or pervasive that it creates an offensive work environment. If any of you have done any plaintiff's work in this area, you'll know it's not easy to win a workplace harassment case because the severe or pervasive requirement does impose a considerable constraint. Well, nothing like that is present in the proposed rule, which conspicuously omits any such limitation. What's more, this rule applies, as I said, to categories like sexual orientation and gender identity that at least federal employment discrimination law, at least reading the statute as opposed to the recent interpretations by the EEOC, the federal statute doesn't cover. The federal law is limited to the workplace, whereas here it is not. And finally, there is an important constraint on workplace harassment law. Many employees are reluctant to sue, especially before they've left the company or been fired from the company, in part because they don't want to undermine their work relationships. Now, you might like that constraint or not, but it is one reason we're not seeing as many complaints in the workplace harassment context as there could be. Whereas here, anybody, even somebody who doesn't have an existing business relationship with a lawyer, could file a bar complaint, and then it's the bar's job to investigate. This person doesn't have to hire a lawyer. Just says, you know, I was at this bar function, and this person said something that I believe, that I perceive as harassing to me. That's all it takes. And again, it'll be very easy to imagine how some activists would use that in order to shut down law-related functions, again, like continuing legal education and the like, that they perceive as offensive and harassing. So that, I think, is the most serious problem with the proposal. But let me mention one other thing, which also ties into that first point about how the ABA is now trying to get into this general anti-discrimination rule business, and as a result is adding categories that many states do not recognize. Unsurprisingly, given the political tenor of the ABA, this is a pretty broad list, broader than many legislatures are willing to adopt. And one thing on that list I think is absent in nearly every state statute. Perhaps every state statute. I think there are a few city ordinances that cover this, but very few. And that is socioeconomic status. It is professional misconduct for a lawyer to discriminate on the basis of socioeconomic status. So far, I've mostly been talking about the harassment prohibition, which itself restricts speech. But now let's shift away from speech and look at actual action, but action that I think is perfectly legitimate. So let's say, for example, your law firm prefers more educated employees, both as lawyers and as staffers, over less educated ones. So if a paralegal applies for a job, you prefer somebody who has a bachelor's degree or maybe a master's degree in English or a degree from a really impressive university. That may very well be socioeconomic status discrimination. The rules do not define socioeconomic status, but to the extent that it's been defined by the law, it's been in the context of the ban on such discrimination in the sentencing guidelines. That's an individual status in society is determined by objective criteria such as education, income, and employment. Is somebody with a bachelor's higher status than somebody without? Yes, I think so, especially determined by objective criteria such as employment, such as education. So if you prefer Ivy League graduates, you would be jeopardizing your license to practice law. Likewise, let's say you contract with expert witnesses and expert consultants who are especially well-educated or have had especially prestigious past employment. Then in that case, you again are discriminating based on socioeconomic status in conduct related to the practice of law. No law, to my knowledge, prohibits that discrimination because it's perfectly reasonable discrimination. It's discrimination that should be allowed. No, in some situations, maybe wise or unwise, but that's something that should be resolved by each particular lawyer or each particular employer. But this proposal would essentially make that grounds for bar discipline. Or let's say you're trying to choose a partner, and you are figuring out whom to partner up. But let's imagine this is a small partnership. You're a solo, and you're thinking about partnering up with someone else. Would you rather partner up with somebody who is pretty wealthy, or would you rather partner up with someone who is relatively poor? Well, you know, different people have different views. Some people might say, I'd rather partner up with someone who doesn't have a lot of money because he's going to be lean and hungry, and I want that in a partner. Maybe. Alternatively, maybe you'd prefer a wealthier partner because you want a partner who'd have the resources to weather economic hard times and to help the firm do the same. There may need to be investments in the firm, and you'll find it's much easier to get that from somebody who has the socioeconomic status to just write a check. Well, that too would be prohibited under the ABA rule. Or let's say you prefer lower socioeconomic status employees, giving someone who's poor on unemployment a hand up, not in order to promote, quote, diversity, close quote, which is specifically exempted here, but just because you think it's nice. You're not consciously looking for a diverse workforce of mixed socioeconomic status. You simply want to help poor people. Perfectly plausible thing to do. Not for everybody, but if you want to do it, more power to you. Not according to the ABA, or excuse me, it isn't yet the ABA, but to the proposal now before the ABA, that is discrimination based on socioeconomic status relative to the practice of law. I think we can all come up with lots of other hypos here, but the bottom line is that this is just a proposal that, except kind of as a weird form of extremist egalitarian ideology, just makes no sense. I tried to figure out, I tried to ask some people, why would this be so? And I think one thing that might have happened is originally, and in fact some states actually have certain rules banning discrimination in the actual conduct of a case, which often comes up with things like how you treat witnesses. So you can imagine a situation where if a lawyer is beating up on, or I don't mean literally, but is insulting a witness because the witness is poor, let's say, mocking the witness, and let's say not before the jury, where it'll look bad, but in a deposition or something like that. You can imagine saying, look, this is an area, the conduct of actual litigation, where the state bar does have a special reason to intervene, and in that area, it makes sense to say you should treat witnesses fairly, even with regard to something like socioeconomic status. So, in some zone, this might be sensible, but why they adapted, they expanded it to the entirety of the practice of law, including hiring and firing and such. That makes no sense. I mean, it may be that they just weren't really thinking about it, although I actually wrote a comment, and so they had to think some about it. But whether they were deliberately or not, or applying this to socioeconomic status, they clearly are applying the entire prohibition to socioeconomic status. I think that's just a further illustration of just how misguided this kind of excessive egalitarianism is. So let me close on a broader note. I think there are some people who have the view that anti-discrimination law is wonderful, and the more anti-discrimination law, the better. I think that's just wrong. I think there's a reason why we have anti-discrimination law calibrated as it generally is. First, certain kinds of small businesses aren't even covered by Title VII, in part because in a really small business, whom you work with is a matter of important individual choice. Some states apply their anti-discrimination law to any businesses, but others exempt really small businesses. That's something that I think ought to be a legislative judgment that's respected. Likewise, which which criteria what kind of discrimination is prohibited, is something that, too, is a difficult judgment. Some discrimination is perfectly wise, discriminating based on people's intelligence, or discriminating based on people's personal qualities, or discriminating in many situations based on socioeconomic status. Others are much more controversial, such as gender identity, but again, that's not something where the automatic rule should be every government organization that has any hand in regulating anything should try to implement as much anti-discrimination as possible. So that's the rough summary of the main problems with the proposal. I hope the ABA does end up rejecting it. But in any event, if the ABA does accept it, I hope that state bars and state courts, when they're in charge of such things, will not adopt this. And I think one way of trying to prevent this from being adopted is by talking to people. Both. That's why I'm talking to you, and I'm hoping you folks will be talking to others about this as well. So my presentation is done, and we have time for questions and answers.
All right. Thank you for that, Professor. We'll now open the floor to audience questions. In a moment, we will all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. Again, to request the floor, please enter star and then the pound key. We've had two people ring in with questions very quickly here. We'll answer their calls in the order we receive them. If at any point during their questions you would like to join the queue, again, please hit star and then the pound key. Let's go to our first caller.
I'd like to know if under current rules in law, there would be anything prohibiting an attorney from using the most vile racial epithet or anti-Semitic language in public, and what the difference would be between how you would identify the difference between vulnerability to punishment in those cases versus vulnerability to punishment in the cases that you are concerned about.
Under current law, there is no such prohibition if we're talking about it in public, and there should be no such prohibition. If a lawyer wants to be go to a KKK rally and have a sign that says "I hate niggers," he is free to do that because of the First Amendment. The First Amendment protects people's rights to express views, including offensive views. Now, in the courtroom, he wouldn't be able to do that. Just like in the courtroom, he couldn't say insulting or offensive things more broadly either. Not just because they're racist, but even ones that are not racist or bigoted in any way. In the courtroom, which is a special kind of context, a special government-run proceedings, as we know, there are lots of rules. I mean, just to give an example, if you get up in court and start telling the jury something that is based on evidence that's been excluded, you can be silenced from saying that because, again, there are special rules for what can be said in the courtroom. Let me just finish.
Sure, I'm sorry.
Giving a third category. Now, in the workplace, there are some restrictions imposed by workplace harassment law. Again, I have written criticizing some of those restrictions on First Amendment grounds. I think that if you're talking to a particular person, those kinds of restrictions on personal insults said to the person might be constitutional. But if you're just talking about some issue, I think you are. You should be free to do that. I think workplace harassment law right now doesn't agree with me on that. But again, note the limitations. Workplace harassment law requires that the material be severe or pervasive enough to create an offensive environment. That's not a perfect limitation, but it's a limitation that's deliberately absent from the proposed rule. Likewise, it's limited to the workplace. The rule is also applies to, again, things like continuing legal education activities, which are not the workplace. And finally, keep in mind that the rule is not limited to epithets. The rule deliberately covers a wide range of speech, any speech that manifests bias or prejudice towards others. So if somebody says something like, you know, I think Catholicism is an unsound religion. I think this whole papal hierarchy or church hierarchy is just there to keep people down, and I just don't understand how anybody could be foolish enough to believe that. If that's the view that one expresses over dinner at a bar function, one could be subject to bar discipline. That, it seems to me, is clearly unconstitutional and goes well beyond any rules that currently exist.
So I was just going to say, there's no rules of professional responsibility requiring the attorney to uphold the reputation of the profession. I thought there was one there, and I thought people could be vulnerable.
That require people to uphold the reputation of the profession. But they're not applied to basically saying, therefore, you cannot express offensive viewpoints that some people find reflect badly on the profession. There is one case involving not just somebody who said racist things, but somebody who was essentially an activist in an extremist racist movement, where the Illinois bar authorities actually did exclude someone from the bar for that. I think that that's not correct. It never went to court. It was just an administrative agency decision. But more broadly, look, let's say some lawyer gets up and says, I hate America. America is an evil country. I just can't wait for the communists to take over. That's something that may very well reflect badly on the reputation of the profession, but that's fully protected speech. Or if the lawyer expresses some extremely anti-military views, especially in time of war, that may reflect badly on the reputation of the profession, but that's protected speech. Likewise, if somebody says something that's sharply critical of a religion, or sharply critical of gays or lesbians, or sharply critical of whites or blacks or anybody else, you know, whether people like it or not, that's what the reputation of the profession test is all about, whether people like it or not, that's protected speech.
So what I was getting at was wondering if this would be made any better with the addition of the word invidious before prejudice or discrimination.
Absolutely not, because the First Amendment protects invidious prejudice, protects viewpoints generally, whether they're seen by some as invidious. First of all, what constitutes invidious discrimination and invidious viewpoints and what doesn't, it depends entirely on the ideology of the observer. If somebody is talking about how whites are bad and whites are responsible for all the harm in the world and how that means that every individual white person, even if he himself didn't engage in discrimination or slave owning or whatever, is therefore responsible, is that invidious prejudice or is that a reasonable, plausible interpretation of the historical fact and of moral thinking? Of course, it all depends on what the observer is and who the observer is, and that is why, in fact, First Amendment law leaves those kinds of judgments to each individual and not to the government. On top of that, you know, some people may have invidious, in the sense of harsh and expressing hostility views about certain religious groups. I have such views about, for example, extremist Muslims. I think most Muslims are perfectly decent, law-abiding people. But yes, certain people who adhere to extremist jihadist Muslim ideology, I hate them. I hate their views. I think their views are evil. Because ultimately, my view is that religion, as an ideology, has to be subject to criticism and sometimes outright hate, just like other ideologies. I hate people who are communists or Nazis. I hate extremist jihadist Muslims. Certainly, I hate their views. You know, there may be a few people who adhere to those views who are just misguided, but otherwise decent people. Pretty rare. I'd say that about very few Nazis or communists. I'd say that about very few jihadists. Does that mean that my views, because somebody says they're invidious, are constitutionally unprotected? I don't think so. Or worse, does it mean that my views are protected only because people nod and say, oh yeah, those views are sensible and therefore not invidious? But hostility to Catholicism, well, that's foolish and that's wrong, so therefore it is invidious. It shouldn't be for government officials to decide which viewpoints are invidious and therefore which viewpoints should be subject to suppression.
All right, we picked up two more questions during that answer, during that exchange, rather, and so we have three questions now. We'll move to the next one.
This is Bjorn Ruthroff in Philadelphia. I'd like to ask you to address something which concerns me greatly. My career has been in litigation, and I think that this speech code, as you call it, will greatly harm our clients. And by that I mean that rough cross-examination is often necessary and can be effective or not, but that's the litigator's obligation on behalf of her client. But if it's perceived to be harmful to someone because of their protected status under this provision, that cross-examination is not going to be held. And it seems to me that you can run through a whole series of aspects of this in which the potential real harm, other than restricting our speech as lawyers, the real harm is going to come in less zealous advocacy for clients, because lawyers are not stupid, and they're not going to make the cross-examination or seek to strike the objectionable juror if it's going to be perceived or asserted to be based on an improper standard. And I've had that attack taken to me in the courtroom. So it seems to me that in addition to harming us, which is bad enough, but the real problem is that this is going to harm clients, and the rules of professional conduct are intended to protect clients. That's my
thought. I'm glad you brought this up, because I should have noted this at the outset. To the credit of the proposal, it does have a specific provision that says that it does not, I'm quoting here, does not prohibit legitimate advocacy that is material and relevant to factual or legal issues or arguments in a representation. If that is properly applied, then in that case, that should leave open harsh cross-examination, including a cross-examination that sometimes relates to race or religion or sexual orientation or whatever else, in trying to identify that the witness might have sort of a romantic motive for bias in a particular claim, bias towards one or another party. You might bring out the person's sexual orientation, or in trying to identify as a possible source of bias in a lawsuit against the church that the person is a member of that very church, that would bring out the person's religion. Those things are specifically excluded from the rule by the language that I just read. Now, of course, if that language is not properly read, then people would be chilled from engaging in such cross-examination, although the fact is when you cross-examine people, you already know that there are other kinds of constraints on you, including rules that prohibit kind of undue harassment of witnesses, and this is harassment in not the bigoted sense, but just in the sense of kind of unduly hostile expressions or excessive repetition or invasion of privacy or some such. So that already is pretty heavily regulated behavior. I'm not sure that this rule would add much to it. So that's why all of my examples did not involve dealing with witnesses in court or in depositions or the like. Because those are things that are specifically exempted from the scope of the rule.
So a couple of thoughts, and thank you. First, to me, the point which you correctly make, which is that there are already inhibitions or prohibitions against certain kinds of cross-examination, and certainly one of those is the sense of fairness in the jurors, already limits what we do. But I'm saying to you two things. First, that I have seen this used as a weapon, and this would give an additional substantial number of tools to people who want to use it. And secondly, remember, you said if it's properly applied. In the courtroom, the judge's default easy position, where he or she will not get reversed, is to sustain the objection to censor the speech. They're not going to get reversed on that. But if they rule in your favor, then they may. So that I have no confidence whatever that the language you're speaking about will turn out to be applied in a way which is fair to our clients.
So that's possible, although remember, these rules are not rules for conduct in the courtroom that would be enforced by the judge in that courtroom, generally speaking. So the question isn't how a judge would react to a certain form of cross-examination. The question is how would bar authorities in case a complaint is brought. And yes, if bar authority's view would be to read that exception very narrowly, then that would be very bad.
Well, yeah, thank you.
We have two questions remaining on the line now. We'll go to the next one in just a moment. If you'd like to join our queue, I invite you to do so by hitting star and then the pound key.
Oh, hi. Thank you. Boy, am I ever glad I saw this email. I had no idea this was going on in the ABA, which I proudly left about 15 years ago.
Well, as they say, you may not be interested in the ABA, but the ABA is interested in you.
No, I agree, and I really applaud your efforts. I just want to know what more can we do. I mean, you know, if you see clearly this is, you know, we have to call it what it is. This is just another attempt by sort of the radical left to come in and try to control things, and this will definitely be used as a method of intimidation against probably 90% conservative or more traditional positions. I mean, any lawyer that takes a case defending a religious liberty case or, you know, defending against a discrimination case is now going to be subject to tons of ethical, if this type of thing gets passed, will be subject to tons of ethical complaints because, like you said, they will glean every little thing that they could find in New York City. Instead of, if someone dares not to use the neutral term Z, they will then become, you know, at a bar function, they will then be brought up on charges of being anti-gay and lesbian. So I just wanted to thank you for this, but it's also very frightening to our profession. I think this is, I fought college speech codes 30 years ago when they started, and we see how pernicious that is. And so I just wanted to applaud you and find out what more we can do to stop this. I don't think there's any use, well, there may be some use in trying to fine tune this language. I mean, this thing just needs to be stopped, and I challenge the ABA. We need to challenge the ABA to say what on earth benefit to clients, just like the last couple callers said. What is any benefit to clients or the legal profession is going to result from this? And the burden should be on them. I mean, this is, I can't see of a single benefit. I mean, have anybody, I mean, clearly the history of this must come from the, what is the, who started this? I missed the first 5 minutes of the phone call. Where was this begun?
This is a proposal to the ABA from a subcommittee of the ABA.
Yeah, which
and how exactly it was assigned and how the people were chosen, I can't speak to that. I will say, though, that what you mentioned points out, I think, another important area that's related to the practice of law that could be covered here, and that is, of course, this public commentary about cases that have an important kind of ideological dimension to them. Those are, I think, related to the practice of law. Certainly lawyers who essentially engage in this kind of cause litigation certainly recognize that publicity related to the litigation is often as important as success or failure in the courtroom. There's been many, many sound settlements, for example, that have been gotten because a government defendant has concluded that, or a private defendant has concluded that, that their actions, even if legally defensible, are looking bad to the public. Now, some statements, out-of-court statements about pending cases, are indeed subject to some control, but that is solely for in situations where the statements might undermine the fairness, especially of a jury trial. But outside that narrow zone, if somebody wants to say, yes, we are challenging this government policy of allowing anybody who thinks of themselves as female into the women's or girls' restroom, we're challenging this policy because we think that there should be no accommodations for people who are transgender because we think that it's a mental illness that should be treated rather than accommodated. I'm actually not sure that that's at all right. My inclination is probably that that's a mistake, both medically and tactically, but let's say that that is their argument they're making. If that's in their press release about the filing of the lawsuit, that is a statement related to the practice of law. That, too, might lead to them being disciplined or even disbarred because of the viewpoint that they're expressing. And I do think that this is something that people know how to fight it within the ABA. I wish they would. I don't know, but somebody might. But in any event, even if the ABA adopts it, I think it's important for people to to resist the, for courts and bars to be, to resist the urge to just adopt this because it's in the model rules, and for people to urge state bars and state courts to so resist.
No, thank you. Thank you. We'll be following up.
We have three questions on our line right now. We'll go to the next one. At any point, I invite you to join the conversation by hitting star and the pound key to join our queue.
Good afternoon, Professor. Thank you so much for bringing this to everyone's attention. My name is Celeste, and I'm in California. I'm trying to see, how does this apply to political views within the office, and there's this, you know, Democrat-Republican thing going, and but historically you can point back to the Democrats where they have been KKK members. It has been very, very racial, et cetera, George Wallace, all of that. And then applying it to where, you know, if you are an African-American Republican and you are in an office that is filled with Democrats that are just absolutely opposed to everything that you stand for, how would these rules apply?
Well, they would apply. Unfortunately, hostile work environment harassment law also applies there. But again, these rules are even broader. They don't require showing of severity or pervasiveness. They just require a showing that somebody is expressing views, including political views. There's no exception at all for political views that are seen as prejudiced or that manifest bias or prejudice towards others because of their membership in particular groups. So if somebody is talking about the supposed evils of some religious group or about whether we should have more immigration from certain countries and less immigration from other countries, that's something that no matter how closely tied it is to the political debate could lead to a bar complaint. And again, you know, maybe ultimately the bar will say, well, this isn't quite enough to qualify as harassment. But the chilling effect will be felt because who wants to even be the target of a bar complaint, even if ultimately they feel they can beat the complaint.
But wouldn't that almost force me to either be completely mute about what my political views are or how they may apply, even to the benefit of a case?
Well, remember that when it comes to statements within the courtroom, that are legitimate advocacy that's material or relevant to factual or legal issues or arguments in a representation, then in that case, that would be exempted. So I'm not so much worried about how this would apply to advocacy in a case, although maybe it might apply to people kind of talking and planning and strategizing in the law firm, although that too probably would be seen as relevant to the arguments. I think it would more apply to just people trying to talk about their politics. Now, you know, some employers say, we don't want you to talk about politics in the workplace. But others say, no, by all means, please do. That's fine. And even if there are going to be some constraints for things that are seen as rude, those are constraints that would be imposed as a result of this kind of private decision and private ordering. This basically says the government is going to tell lawyers that you can't express certain views.
Exactly. Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
We have three questions still remaining on our line. We'll keep moving along. Please hit star and the pound key if you'd like to join the queue.
Good afternoon. This is Dale Owens. I'm in Georgia. The thing that strikes me about this is that all this debate about would it be applied right or wrong is really an impossible debate because the terms are completely undefined.
Mm-hmm.
No one knows what discrimination means at its edges anymore. No one knows what harassment means at its edges anymore. And every time we open the paper or turn on the news or pull up a website, we see some new attempt to use those concepts. And it seems like to me the best way to respond to this or challenge this is to simply say, what does it mean? And then not accept the idea that some central question, you know, using racial epithets and that sort of thing, is what this is all about, or that it's, you know, different because it's an issue of livelihood. And I wonder if there's been any consideration of comparing this to the prevalence in the McCarthy era of dealing with people you disagree with by calling them communists and having their businesses boycotted or shut down. Or, you know, in totalitarian societies, Cuba, for example, the all-purpose weapon is to call somebody counter-revolutionary.
Mm-hmm.
And it's simply a weapon, as one of your other callers said. And that's when I read this, that strikes me as that's what we're really talking about here, is weaponizing words that have no fixed meaning and where people disagree strongly about what they mean, and they are extended beyond all original understanding. So I wonder what you thought about analogizing it to those concepts in other societies that most people nowadays think are you know, bad. We're bad in this country when we had McCarthy, and are bad in places like Cuba under totalitarian societies.
Yeah, excuse me. I'm a little hesitant to try to draw too many analogies to others, to what's happened in other societies, just because the analogies may be kind of distant and not persuasive to many. But I do think that the analogy to the use of communists during the 1950s, I think, is quite apt. Communist is not an entirely vague term. Certainly some people were proud members of the Communist Party of the United States. Well, those are communists. But what we did see is that an attempt to suppress communist advocacy and membership in Communist Party very quickly moved to fellow travelers, moved to people who were communist sympathizers, moved to people who expressed views that others suspected were communist or communist-like. The same thing we see with talk about harassment and talk about hate speech in the U.S., both under workplace harassment law and in college campuses and the like. There is a core which most people would agree might qualify as the word hate speech, because people think that it's a legal term, but qualify as, say, racist statements, or statements that manifest bias or prejudice, uses racial epithets in many situations, clearly is covered. I think that should be protected in its own terms, because that's protected by the First Amendment, even if it's an expression of views that I think are quite wrong. But at least there you could say, okay, fine, that is something that manifests bias or prejudice. But the problem is we see that lots of people are quite willing to extend it more broadly. I've seen, for example, people arguing on campuses that anti-abortion speech is, they call it hate speech, because they think that it manifests prejudice against women. Now, of course, many of the speakers are themselves women, and they think that abortion is bad for women as well as bad for men. But no, from the perspective of some, because abortions are something that only women can get, and only women would need if they feel they need it, that manifests bias or prejudice, that constitutes hate speech. Likewise, there are some people who say that all support of Trump, any statements supporting Trump, are hate speech. Now, I actually don't support Trump at all, and I do think that Trump has said things that are clearly bigoted. For example, his criticism of the apparently Mexican-American judge who's deciding a case involving, I think, Trump University. But under that standard, the theory is anybody who chalks vote for Trump is engaging in hate speech and should be suppressed, even though this is basically the expression of support for one of the major candidates, unfortunately, in the election. Likewise, criticism of illegal aliens. Now, I actually think some of it is overwrought. I think most illegal aliens are, you know, decent people who are just trying to make a living for themselves and their families. And it's true they're breaking the law. It doesn't make them horrible people. I mean, it's the kind of law that under other circumstances I could imagine myself breaking, and breaking with a relatively clear conscience. This having been said, whether we should deport illegal aliens or whether we should build a wall to try to keep them out, rather actually we already have something of a wall, whether we should build a stronger wall, that's something that has to be an important part of the debate and does not necessarily manifest bias or prejudice, but of course lots of people are very willing to say that it does. Likewise, questions about transgender people in bathrooms or even same-sex marriage, that's something that, again, are very important parts of political debate. I don't think they should be labeled harassment, even if harassment does have some core meaning, But other people are very willing and eager to label them. That precisely because the meaning, while not entirely lacking in specificity, is vague in a lot of areas, and those are areas where people are very happy to push towards a broader and broader understanding of the meaning. One thing, by the way, that I've seen with a lot of these things is when people are defending some of these codes, they say, oh, but these are very narrow. We're only after kind of this horrible stuff. We're only after people shouting nigger at each other or saying all Jews should be killed or something like that. But when the codes are actually implemented, unsurprisingly, and the lessons of history and of McCarthyism and the like show that, now people, maybe the same people, maybe different people, but still lots of people, are now eager to read them very broadly, because once they're there, they become very useful political tools. So that's the danger. That's the danger, is that people are going to try to talk down the scope of the law when they're trying to propose it, or the rule they're trying to propose it, and then people will certainly talk it up once it's actually implemented.
Well, we still have two questions on our line. I think we have enough time to answer both of these and potentially maybe one more. So please do hit star and the pound key if you have a as of yet unanswered question. Let's hear from our next caller.
This is David Applegate, the Chicago Lawyers Chapter, and this is a comment, not a question. As my good friend Ilya Shapiro at the Cato Institute memorably said recently, a free people should not walk on eggshells. We should sleep on nails. So picking up on one of the earlier questioners' remarks, perhaps the appropriate response is not to withdraw from membership in organizations like the American Bar Association, not to abhor and avoid joining the Academy, and not just to work within our own little conservative world, but perhaps it's to join these organizations, get involved, be active in the community, and be active in the debate. Fight fire with fire. Don't sit back meekly and wait as these continuing restrictions are imposed upon us and our freedoms are increasingly restricted. And with that, I yield the floor.
Makes sense to me.
All right, this next question then is our last on the line. Please hit star and the pound key. I think we should probably have time to get to one after this if you have a question.
Hi, this is Warren Belmar in Florida, and I couldn't agree with a lot of what you said more, but there are a couple of points that I think need some clarification. One, these proposals are two-edged swords, and if you are offended by what your colleagues are saying in the political arena or wherever, it seems to me that it would subject them to the same kind of disciplinary and ABA intention. In a recent debate, I raised the question about the inquiry about how they came to add socioeconomic status. And it was clear that it was only socioeconomic status when you were speaking against people of lesser means. But if Hillary Clinton or if Senator Sanders, wanted to attack the 1%, I was told that did not fall within the category of socioeconomic status conduct, which would have subjected the person to potential disciplinary action. And as you noted also, this has been expanded far beyond legal activity to social activity connected to legal events. And I assume that would also apply to CLE programs, which would raise all sorts of obstacles to having a debate on any of these issues or any aspects of it within a sanctioned ABA program, unless everyone agreed that the conduct was totally unoffensive, which is totally unrealistic. So I hope and I will urge the non-adoption of this amendment to the canons of ethics or the disciplinary rules of the American Bar Association.
Oh, well, I appreciate what you're saying, and I do think that in principle this could be used against some of the excesses of the left as well. But in fact, I don't think that's very likely. First, is there is a specific exception for conduct undertaken to promote diversity. So presumably, if you are saying nasty things about whites or about males, if your goal is to promote diversity by persuading people to hire more non-whites or women, then in that case, you'd be just exempted from the rules, no matter how much bias or prejudice your statements manifest. But beyond that, these rules, especially given their vagueness, are going to mean whatever it is that the enforcers want it to mean. And even if the people, the enforcers, are on the left and perfectly well-intentioned, it's a normal human reaction to take vague words and give the benefit of the doubt to people whom we like and to read them as broadly as possible as to people we dislike. So I think lots of people might sincerely believe that someone who's on their side, who's expressing views that even if they don't share are like more extreme versions of their own views, then no, that's not bias or prejudice. That's just talking truth to power. Whereas if somebody on the other side is saying something comparable, well, no, that is manifesting bias or prejudice. So if I am right that many of these bar associations are predominantly staffed by people who are more on the left, then in that case, that's how these vague terms are going to be enforced.
Well, if the legal profession has come to that level of operation, then we all ought to be quite taken aback by it. Criticism to be permissible of a candidate like Romney for attacking the 47%, but not equally applicable to a candidate like Sanders for attacking the 1%, strikes me as an impossibly vague kind of standard, and certainly
vague, and it's viewpoint based. But the proposed rules are themselves viewpoint based. Proposed rules are unashamedly, delightedly aiming to restrict certain viewpoints, those that they see as manifesting bias or prejudice, and not other viewpoints, those that defend equality. So it wouldn't be surprising if once you accept that kind of viewpoint discrimination, then you would also say, well, when we're deciding what manifests bias or prejudice, well, certain viewpoints are more likely to be seen as that, whereas other viewpoints are, again, more likely to be just seen as calls for promotion of diversity or calls for a more fair and just society or whatever else.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we have one more question on the line, and let's make this our final question of the day.
Professor Bullitt, I have a question which you were just almost getting to, which is how are the current bar rules being applied in this area, or especially in states that already have a rule like this? Are we already seeing it being used against those groups? I'm thinking of Texas, which has a fairly similar rule in place, and then there was a pretty specious bar complaint filed against our Attorney General, Ken Paxton, after he issued an opinion on clerks issuing same-sex marriage licenses, which basically restated the current law and said it depends on the facts and circumstances in each individual clerk's situation as to whether Title VII would provide an exception for the clerk to not provide licenses if the clerk disagreed. But do you know of any other examples or places or how this is being used now that might give us some idea of how it will be used?
That's an interesting story. Now I recall vague echoes of it, but I don't think I actually followed it closely. That could be an example of how broadly some people might interpret these rules in filing challenges, although my suspicion is that went nowhere. I just looked up the Texas rules, and the Texas rules say a lawyer shall not willfully, in connection with an adjudicatory proceeding, except as provided in an exception, manifest bias or prejudice based on race, color, national origin, religion, disability, age, sex, or sexual orientation towards any person involved in that proceeding. And then there's an exception when it's advocacy in connection with an adjudicatory proceeding involving those factors, and the advocacy is necessary to address substantive or procedural issues. So what that is limited to is when you're dealing with a particular case and you're talking to or about a particular person involved in that case. So the prohibition does ban certain kinds of discrimination, but a much, much narrower zone. It doesn't apply to just things you say in the law office to your colleagues. It doesn't apply to things you say at dinner at a bar function. It doesn't apply to continuing legal education. It might apply, again, to things you say to a witness on the stand or in a deposition. But, again, that's a much narrower zone than what the proposed rules would cover.
Okay, and just by way of information, the complaint against Paxton is still open, and they're still probing it. They initially dismissed it and then reopened it.
Right. Well, it sounds like even if his statements expressed some hostility to gays or lesbians, and it sounds like they may not have, but even if they had, first, I don't think it would be manifestation of bias based on sexual orientation towards any person involved in that proceeding. And beyond that, it would be necessary in order to address a substantive or procedural issue raised by the proceeding. So I think that that could just be sort of a little political grandstanding by his critics that by the terms of the rule would be pretty clearly excluded.
Agreed. Thank you.
Very much my pleasure.
All right. Professor, do you have any closing thoughts you want to make?
No, I think we've had a great conversation, and it's been a great pleasure.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. This has been very helpful for everyone, I think. We don't have any telephone calls scheduled next week, and that is intentional because we are waiting to see what the Supreme Court might come out with on Monday. So please, everyone, check our schedule on Monday, and we'll get you some very prompt and in-depth coverage of next week's decisions. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.